And I'm not here, by the way, to talk about any pending investigation, to and including the investigation in connection with Secretary Clinton's use of a private email server. So you're welcome to ask me about that, but I promise you you're going to get the same answer, which is that I'm not going to talk about pending investigation, and that I remain close to that investigation to ensure that it's done well and has the resources that are needed. As I've told you all before, my goal in any investigation is to do it well and do it promptly, especially investigations of intense public interest. All of that remains true. And so it remains under investigation, and I have nothing else to say about that. It actually came this morning from, we did our special aid memorial service because Police Week is kicking off, which is always a good event for us, but always heartbreaking to see the families of people. Mm-hmm. One of the special agents who was killed in the terrible cold case squad shooting at Washington, here in D.C., one of their kids now works for us, which is a wonderful thing. And the only thing I want to hit at the outset with you is I also got a briefing this morning on the quarterly stats for homicide in the nation's largest cities. And I've talked to you about this before, and I was very worried about it last fall, and I am in many ways more worried because the numbers are not only going up, they're continuing to go up in most of those cities faster than they were going up last year. And I worry very much it's a problem that most of America can drive around. From the Las Vegas Strip, you can't tell that more than 60 people have been murdered in Las Vegas this year. From the Miracle Mile in Chicago, you can't hear the sounds of gunshots that have killed over 200 people so far this year. And lots of other cities, as I said, most of the, I think it was 42 or 3 I got briefed on, most of them have seen an increase. And it's again, happening in certain parts of the cities, and the people dying are almost entirely Black and Latino men, and we can't drive around that problem. And so I raise it with you all because I hope it's being reported on at local levels, but it, in my view, it's not getting the attention at the national level it deserves. I don't know what the answer is, but holy cow, do we have a problem. And obviously, I continue to believe it's really important that law enforcement and communities, especially communities of color, continue to talk to each other. And so the Bureau is still trying to be part of that drive and that conversation. Mike has arranged for me to go down to the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham a week after next as part of trying to continue the conversation about, especially about race and law enforcement. And so I'm sure some of you will hear about that when I do it. And that's it. So now I'll be quiet. We'll try and do our usual organized way. I usually begin at my left hand, right?
On Apple, two questions, if I may. First of all, was your on-the-spot math in London correct? was it, in fact, more than 1.3 million or whatever we all figured out it
Mike
was?
Mike loved that I was just winging that.
And secondly, with the two cases having collapsed for obvious reasons, aren't we left with a court order in Brooklyn that says that Apple doesn't have to respond to an All Writs Act order? And is that where we still are, that Apple is not responding to All Writs Act orders in the federal government?
First, I'm not going to get into, I probably shouldn't have been cute trying to estimate for you how much it costs. It cost a lot of money. And my wife discovered that many of you misreported my salary, which is $178,100. She wanted to know where the extra $4,000 was. But look, it cost a lot of money. And in my view, it was well worth it. And so to your question, Pete, about the cases, there is still a court order that's not been vacated, a decision by the magistrate judge in Brooklyn that I'm sure will be cited and discussed, certainly in cases, if there are future cases in that jurisdiction, and I've no doubt elsewhere. As I've said many times before, the San Bernardino case was about that phone, but given the prevalence of devices that we can unlock in law enforcement investigations, I'm sure there's going to be other court cases. We're collecting data on ours. I think Amy has testified to this. First 6 months of this fiscal year, the numbers, about 4,000 devices were examined by FBI experts, and about 500 of them could not be unlocked. And I expect that number just to grow as the prevalence of the technology grows with newer models. So we're going to be, we got to continue to grapple with this as a country, and I'm sure there will be cases and cases where that decision will be a feature. I've said before, I think litigation is a poor place to try to resolve issues that involve values we all hold dear. But in individual investigations, I'm highly confident prosecutors are going to pursue court orders to try and get into devices where they have a search warrant.
Can I just follow up on that and ask you, we understand why you wanted to get in the phone in San Bernardino. You've made that quite clear that you didn't think the investigation would be thorough without doing so. Having done that now, did you find any breakthrough evidence in it?
I'm not going to say. Even in hindsight, I'm very glad we got into the phone. It was important. How good are you, Pam?
Just piggybacking off what Pete was asking, have you had to use that same tool that you used to get into the San Bernardino phone and other phones yet?
I don't think we have yet. Mm-hmm. We're trying to figure out a mechanism where we can use the tool to help in other investigations. Again, it's a narrow thing, which is a 5C running an iOS 9 mm-hmm. operating system, and we're trying to figure out how we can help state and local law enforcement, if they have a court order, how we can do that and still maintain the viability of the tool. And that work is underway right now. I expect in the near future we'll have figured out how we're going to do it. And then we'll tell local law enforcement, if you send us a phone, here are the rules. But, look, I want to make sure that if there are ways to use it in appropriate cases, we do. But I don't think we've used it yet.
In terms of the basic narrative of San Bernardino, is that still, as you described it earlier, no information about direction from overseas, control from overseas, but simply inspired by it, as far as we know?
Right. Nothing's changed in our assessment of it.
And then on the issue of the violence, why do you think that this story hasn't gotten as much attention, and does the country truly understand the impact of what I call a chronic plague, where you literally have hundreds of people being shot and killed and even greater numbers maimed on a regular basis?
I don't know the answer to the first part of the question. The second part of the question is, I think because it hasn't been talked about on a national level a whole lot, I'm sure people don't fully appreciate what's going on. And as I said, there's been lots of local conversation and reporting, and Chicago's had a ton of it. And Chicago's generated some national attention, but I don't think there's been a whole lot of reporting looking at, so what's going on? And why does Dallas see a dramatic spike, but Houston doesn't? I mean, remember I talked to you all about last fall, I said that the map in the calendar makes no sense. And it's a complicated, hard issue, but the stakes couldn't be higher. A whole lot of people are dying. And I don't want to drive around it. Sorry, go ahead.
Can you elaborate, please, on the public statement from Amy Hess from a couple weeks ago about the VEP? I think, you know, you heard some rumblings in the technologist community about how is it possible the Bureau could spend a lot of money for this device, this tool, and not fully grasp the mechanics of how it works. And so can you sort of elaborate on how that's possible and why that decision was made in this particular situation?
Sure. I mean, sometimes you can buy a tool that helps you accomplish something. Sometimes you can buy the guts of the tool, right? The software behind it, the code behind it, and there's a difference between those two things. Our goal, I know you all have heard me say this many times, the goal in San Bernardino was to investigate the case and get into that phone. And so we bought what was necessary to get into that phone. And we tried not to spend more money than we needed to spend, but we spent the money we needed to be able to get into that phone. We did not in any form or fashion structure the transaction of the thing with an eye towards avoiding the VEP. I would be shocked if anybody even thought about the VEP or the VEP at the time this was going on. We bought what we needed to buy to get into the phone.
But why is it important to understand just sort of the mechanics and the basics of how it gets you into the phone just for potential future purpose?
Why is it important?
Why isn't it important? It seems like that might be desirable to sort of know how it works from start to finish.
I suppose it could be, but it might cost you a whole lot more money. And if your interest is in investigating a particular terrorist attack, getting a particular phone, I don't know why you would spend that dough. And the Bureau is not in the business of trying to purchase all kinds of vulnerabilities. We're in the business of trying to investigate cases in a good way. So I'll go over here and then I'll go back across.
Perfect setup. Thank you, Eric. I wanted to ask a question right on that. So, so given that some of the tech policy experts are saying that if you don't disclose the vulnerability to the software maker, that increases the security risks for, you know, consumers, companies, anyone who might be using a phone or running the software on the computers. So should there be a policy, do you think it would be wise on a from a policy perspective to say when you are purchasing exploits, you should at the same time try to get as much information about the underlying vulnerability or make sure you have the technical details on the underlying vulnerability so that you can at least submit it to the VEP so they can make a decision about the disclosure, you know, for the purposes of weighing, you know, security risks versus, you know, law enforcement equities?
I don't know. I don't think I've thought about that well enough to give you an intelligent answer. I guess among the things I'd want to ask if folks were chewing on that as a policy matter is, if you can get it for free, okay. What if you have to spend multiples of the board director's salary to get that? And so what makes, I just haven't thought about it well enough. It was not a consideration here. The goal was to get a tool to get us into the phone.
Do you think you would have had to spend much more money in this case to get that information from
you? I don't know. My guess is we'd have to spend more. Mm-hmm. But I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't know whether there was even that was even part of the conversations with the private party, because again, our goal was, you have a tool that you've demonstrated to us will get us into this phone. Okay. How much that costs, and you know, how do we get that quickly so we can get into the phone? I don't even know whether it was a consideration. But as far as the policy question, I haven't thought about that well enough to give you a good answer.
Okay.
Two different issues. Just following up on Pierre on the rise in violence. In the last year, you linked that issue to police possibly backing off, the so-called Ferguson effect. You're now seeing the increase continue. You got crosswise with the White House on this last year. Do you stand by that, that it could be an outgrowth of the Ferguson effect, or what do you think now?
I resist the term Ferguson effect because, to me, I think that is still, what I'm talking about is the sort of the viral video effect and changes in the way police may be acting and in the way communities may be acting in terms of how much information they share with police could well be one at the heart of this or could well be an important factor in this. And the reason I resist Ferguson effect is Ferguson, at least to my recollection, wasn't about videos. I think it is the potential effect of marginal pullbacks by lots and lots of police officers that is changing some cities. I continue to hear that privately.
Did you hear anything in your briefings today that made you more convinced of that or more questioning of that?
No, I just continue to hear. I've heard it from the folks who briefed me, and I've heard it in lots of conversations privately with police leaders that they perceive in lots of places in the country a change in the way police are doing their work. And as I said, and the way communities are interacting with police, there's a perception, I don't know whether it's true or not, that folks are less likely to tell police when they see things, and there's a perception that police are less likely to do the marginal additional policing that suppresses crime, the getting out of your car at 2 in the morning and saying to a group of guys, hey, what are you doing here? And instead, doing your job, right, responding to 911 calls, making arrests. But what's continuing to be suggested to me in private is there's lots of impacts to police departments at the margins and communities. Again, I don't know for sure whether that's an answer. What I'm hopeful of, and I've seen some signs of it, is that academics will dive into this and the media will dive into this because something is happening. And, you know, sometimes people say to me, well, the increases are off of historic lows. How does that make any of us feel any better? Right? I mean, a whole lot of more people are dying this year than last year, and last year than the year before, and I don't know why for sure.
And I know you don't want to talk about the Hillary emails, but I'm asking anyway. I try not to. Okay. You've indicated publicly, Niagara Falls, and like a few other places, that you were going to finish this up on your own schedule. You were in no rush. The convention wasn't a factor. Nothing else was a factor. But is there a concern in the director's office that this investigation is now the subject of so much scrutiny and speculation that you're affecting a presidential election in a negative way.
Yeah, all I would do, Eric, is repeat what I said before. In any investigation, especially one of intense public interest, and I felt this about San Bernardino, we want to do it well, and we want to do it promptly. And so I feel pressure to do both of those things. What I said someplace is I don't tether to any particular external deadline. But look, I understand the interest in this particular investigation, and so I do feel the pressure to do it well and promptly. But as between the two, we will always choose well. And so that's the same general answer I hope I've been given before.
Following up on the violent crime issue.
You screwed up my bouncing.
I'm sorry. I was curious because, property crime was down, so according to some of the statistics, 4.2%. Is there a threat of, oversimplification in terms of blaming us on the viral video effect? If, when you're talking about the cities that are mostly responsible for the hike in homicides, that's the hike in homicides, at least half of them are responsible, or three cities are responsible for about half of that spike. So, is there a worry that there's an oversimplification here, that given that, we've seen a big drop in property crime numbers from last year?
Yeah, I don't know. Anytime you talk about crime, there's always a worry about oversimplification. And I'll say it again, I don't know what is driving this. And it could be, it's simply a collection of individual factors in different cities. It's hard for me to believe that there isn't something broad that's affecting it, but maybe it could be. Maybe the reason that we're seeing a jump in homicide in different cities all over the country is driven by factors in those particular areas. Again, Chicago's had a huge increase, but again, when you see the numbers, I think you'll see a significant number of cities have seen a significant jump in their homicide rate this quarter against last year, and last year was an increase. So I don't know. There's always a danger of oversimplification. These are really hard questions. Academics wrestle with it. I'm just urging, I think everybody ought to wrestle with it because something's going on.
Public policy solution to, if this really is attributable to, a viral video effect, what's the public policy solution there, right? Because private citizens have the right to record police officers operating
in public. Of course. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with scrutiny. If that is a part of what's going on in some of these cities, then, and I've said this publicly many times, it's incumbent upon leaders in the police organizations and in the communities to agree we all want the same kind of policing. We want up-close, respectful, appropriate policing. We want police officers to get out of their car at midnight or 2 a.m., walk up to the five guys on the street corner and say, hey, you guys live around here? And have a conversation with them up close. Everybody wants that. And so if there's something going on in the community where there are fewer and fewer of those conversations, leadership in the police needs to make sure their officers understand that's what's expected, and leaders in the community need to say, that's exactly what we want. We want you out of your cars talking to these people in an appropriate, respectful way. And sometimes what I've said I think has been mischaracterized. I'm not against scrutiny of police. I think that's fabulous and has worked some important changes in the last couple of years, and I hope it continues to. What I'm worried about is we all agree we want the same kind of policing, and if it's not happening, we need to talk about why. That's it. So I'm going to keep bouncing, though, because I promise I'm going to...
An issue related to that is the pledge to develop a database on police encounters with residents. Are you concerned that it's taking too long to get that up and going? The last we've heard that it's a workable database won't be up and running for at least 2 to 3 years.
Yeah. I'd love to do it tomorrow, but the good news is everyone in law enforcement agrees we got to build it. The hard part is the execution of it, not the willingness. So actually the thing that you worry about most is that folks don't want to do it. That's not the case. People want to do it. Big departments, small departments at the federal level. And so there's good progress being made, but yeah, it's going to take, I don't know exactly what the estimate is, but it's going to take us probably at least 2 years to get it up and running. And that does frustrate me because I think, as I've said to police organizations, there's nothing more inherently governmental than law enforcement's use of deadly force in encounters with citizens. So we in government ought to be collecting that data and sharing it in a transparent way with everybody. The good news is everybody agrees with that. And so the execution We'll do it as fast as we can do it. At the same time, we're also pushing to get better crime data for the country, which will take, I hope we can do it in 3 years. Everybody in law enforcement is committed to 5 years. From this past fall, we will be in a NIBRS world, which is a richer data world for all of us, and the country will be much better off.
But isn't participation an issue? I mean, right now you don't get, you know, total participation even in crime data collection.
Yeah, it's voluntary, sure.
Correct. And this case, too, aren't there departments out there who, you know, are hesitant to provide data on deadly encounters with residents?
No department has told me that yet. I've heard from all the police organizations, the sheriff's organizations, that everybody's on board with this. We'll see as we get down to the delivery, but it is voluntary, except we have an opportunity to talk about it publicly. You can imagine a circumstance where nearly everyone's doing it, then we'll have to point out who's not doing it and talk about it. So, Catherine.
On the emails, Director Comey, are you doing a security inquiry?
I'm sorry?
On the emails, are you doing a security inquiry?
I don't know what that means.
So it's a criminal investigation.
We're conducting an investigation. That's the Bureau's business. That's what we do. And that's probably all I can say about it.
The reason I ask is that Mrs. Clinton consistently refers to it as a security inquiry, but the FBI does criminal investigations. Just want to see
if you. Right, it's in our name.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
I'm not familiar with the term security inquiry.
Three quick things. One, would it be possible to get the data you're referencing in terms of the homicide spikes the last quarter?
So
we're all on the same page.
Sure. It's not my data. I got it from the major city chiefs, but Mike will follow up, see if we can get you that data.
Two, I think you used the word you were too cute, perhaps, talking about how much you spent on Apple. And I know you're an advocate of transparency in government. It was taxpayer money. I assume that was used to pay to crack the phone. Why not say how much it cost, just flat out?
Yeah, a variety of reasons that I don't want to go into, but I'm not comfortable giving you the precise number.
But, okay.
I mean, what there is, let's imagine.
But you already kind of said it's more than $1.3 million if you factor out my salary, so why not just clear that up and just be transparent about how much it actually cost?
Well, I think I've been transparent enough that people understand it costs a lot of money. And for a number of reasons, I don't want to go into that.
You're worried about making it more expensive for the next time. What other
negotiating point?
Public money.
Number of reasons.
It's related.
Congress
is now weighing an amendment to Rule 41 so that you guys can remotely access computers not in the jurisdiction. What would you say to privacy advocates who are very concerned about this potential change?
Yeah, I'd want to correct your characterization of it. It does nothing to change any of the FBI's authorities. You still need to get a search warrant, make a showing of probable cause, explain to the court what we're doing and how. It's just the question is what judge can issue a search warrant? And in complex computer crime cases, given the nature of the dark web, for example, and given the nature of huge botnets, it is problematic for some of our most important investigations if we have to go to dozens of different magistrate judges in a botnet case, or if we're unable to go to a magistrate judge because we can't say for sure where the computer is, even if we have probable cause to believe that computer is involved in serious criminal activity. So it's to solve that problem where the digital age has made physical location less of a determinant than it is in the pre-digital age. But that's what I worry about, is if folks talk about it like changes the FBI's authorities. Not a teeny bit, not at all. It's the question is what judge can we go and make the showing to? Go to Paul.
First question, last night, the stabbings in Massachusetts, have you seen any link to terrorism in that case yet, and the motives?
I don't know enough to say.
All right, following up on that, what is the status of the FBI's relationship with Apple and other tech companies? I know you've said that you want to continue to have a conversation. On its face, it seems that things are becoming increasingly acrimonious. You know, you double down in the EDNY case, then you guys pulled out because he said that he would give you the password, and Microsoft came out and sued you. Tech overwhelmingly sided with Apple. How are things specifically with Apple and then generally with the tech industry?
Actually pretty good. We have differences in litigation, but But I think that's why litigation is not a productive place to discuss collision among values, premium values. But overall, I'd say our relationship with Apple and the tech companies are productive and appropriate. Often tech companies are victims, and we're investigating things people try to do to them. And I hope the tech companies think that we do that well. And oftentimes, we're serving them with lawful process, and they're cooperating with lawful process. So I characterize this overall well. It's not a monolith. And so with some, especially if we're in litigation, it can be tenser than others. But not what folks would imagine, actually. Yeah, so that's my verdict on it. So I'll bounce over here, sir.
Have you seen anything going on the Hill that would, on the encryption issue, the Senator Burr and Feinstein have a draft working proposal? Have you seen that? Is it something that you'd support?
I've seen it. The Bureau doesn't take position on on legislation, so I have nothing to offer there. One of the things I like about is it continues to drive the conversation that I think we need to have about how we as a country want to govern ourselves. And so that's it. I have to stop there because it's Department of Justice's job to take position on litigation. And I'll go across to you.
A couple questions. First, on the iPhone case, do you personally know yourself who the third-party contractor was who unlocked the iPhone for the FBI?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess
you don't mean personally know yourself. I guess yes, yeah.
You have.
I have a good sense of who the person.
A good sense, or you know the identity of the contractor.
I have a good sense. I couldn't give you people's names.
But the name company. of the company, let's say that they're with.
I don't want to answer that one.
Okay. Another one. The FBI's shared responsibility committees were reportedly supposed to be rolled out months ago. It seems like that's run into some delays. The pilot launch is still in process. What's the delay, and does it have to do with the criticism that those projects have received from civil rights advocates?
I don't think so. First of all, I don't have any reason to think it's connected to criticism. I know last I got briefed on it that we're trying to pilot it in, I forget, 3 to 5 cities, I think, to see how it works. I hope that the folks who are concerned about it will engage and dig into the details of it, because I think if they dig into it, they'll be like, oh, that sounds pretty sensible. Unless I'm missing something, nothing about any criticism or controversy has delayed what we're trying to do. Yeah, and I should explain to everybody, I think you all get this, what we're trying to do is we're trying to use our good offices to connect providers, social service providers, medical providers, counseling providers, who may be in an appropriate situation, able to take a referral from us of someone that we're looking at who we don't think we need to use the criminal justice system to incapacitate, and see if they can't redirect, especially that young person, a troubled person. And we see it as trying to foster some sort of off-ramp. It won't be a lot of these cases, but in cases where we find someone we think, hope we don't have to lock that person up. Maybe we can get them the help that they need. And that's the idea. And not to be run by the Bureau, but the reason we're driving it is we know everybody. And so the idea is SAC in your community, pull that group together, tell them when you have an appropriate referral, you'll send somebody to them.
And so if not criticism, do you know why the delay?
I don't. Okay. I don't. Yeah. I'm going to keep bouncing. Bounce.
I guess today the FBI Agents Association is going to be one of those law enforcement agencies on the Hill that's speaking out against the sentencing reform bill. Do you share kind of a stance with them at all, or do you think that some of the issues you were talking about with homicides rising in cities, is it all playing into people speaking out against some of those issues in particular?
I don't know. I don't know what their concerns are. As I said, I wouldn't comment on specific legislation. What I've said publicly is my general sense is that the ideas animating the work in the Senate and the House seems sensible in general to me. But I don't know what their particular concerns are. And I don't connect the two to a rise in what they're talking about on the Hill, which to my mind, my recollection focuses in a good way on trying to reduce recidivism, trying to get people skills and drug treatment, all those kinds of things in jail, which I think is one of the few things people across the spectrum agree upon. So I don't know that. Ma'am.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, actually, I wanted to ask about the criminal justice reform efforts as well. How much do you think the rising homicide rates should factor into those discussions on the Hill? Do you think they should impact the course of these proposed reforms?
Yeah, to the extent that the conversations on the Hill are focused on trying to reduce recidivism and trying to get people skills and treatment and whatnot, I see them as, in a way, connected, because it's about trying to reduce repeat offense. So that's probably what I'd say about that. And more generally, I guess I don't know any enough about the specifics beyond that kind of stuff to offer a reaction.
I gotta keep bouncing.
then we'll go rando.
I got two questions. First, on the emails, I know you don't want to talk about any details. Normally, conduct investigations. If it leads to criminal charges, we all learn what you found. In this case, given the scrutiny that you've acknowledged, regardless of whether this results in criminal charges, do you foresee a mechanism by which you can give a public accounting or report to tell us what you found?
I don't want to say at this point, Mike.
Okay.
Number two,
right. Back in January, when the Iran nuclear accord was signed, the White House said it had secured a commitment from the Iranians to provide information assistance on locating Bob Levinson, who was not returned as part of the swap. It's now been 4 months. Have the Iranians provided any new information that would help you identify what happened to Bob Levinson?
Yeah, not something I can comment on. Bob Levinson remains top of my mind. Literally every day, I think about Bob.
Thanks for doing this. I just wanted to clarify something that you said that I thought you said at the top, that you're evaluating right now whether the iPhone hacking tool can be used in other cases, and I just want to clarify that that's what you said, and then I have an additional question.
Yeah, we're trying to figure out, I mean, in theory, it can be used in any case where there's a court order for a 5C running iOS 9. We're trying to figure out what mechanism, what way should we build that accomplishes that goal. And allows law enforcement around the country with court orders to be able to use our tool. The reason it's a little tricky is one of the great things about our criminal justice system is discovery. And so if we use it in a criminal case, right, in such a way that it becomes a feature of litigation, then the nature of the tool may be exposed and its utility may be significantly decreased. So we're trying to be thoughtful about how to do that. And is it enough to help our colleagues in state and local law enforcement in such a way that we say, look, we're never going to testify. I'm just imagining this. We're never going to testify. Send it to the lab. We'll open it. If we can, we'll send it back to you. But to the extent you need to be able to establish chain of custody or have witness testimony to be able to use what's on that phone, you're not going to be able to. That's one possibility. Another is we say, you know what, we'll take the risk, and so we will be prepared to testify and risk the tool being exposed and then its utility diminishing. That's what we're sorting through right now. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Okay. And are you looking to see if it can go, if it can be used beyond the 5C? If it can be used on other models?
Yeah, I think we've already checked that out as part of our own work, and my recollection is we're highly confident it works only on a 5C running iOS 9.
Okay, and then I just wanted to ask one additional question just on the encryption issue, because we've been talking about the kind of the data arrest issue, the data that resides on like a phone.
Yeah.
What about the data in motion side of things? How much of a concern is this for you when you're dealing with like services like WhatsApp that's doing end-to-end encryption of like text messages? How are you viewing that as being, is it as significant as data at rest or more significant? And are you looking at bringing court cases on that side of the equation?
No, thank you for that. It's hugely significant. And I would sort it this way. The data at rest problem affects non-national security law enforcement overwhelmingly. The data in motion, at least today, overwhelmingly affects our national security work, because terrorists and their fellow travelers are increasingly using end-to-end encrypted apps. And that is slow. What's happening is those two circles, though, are slowly coming together, because increasingly drug gangs and carjacking gangs are using data in motion facilities that are encrypted. And so, but to oversimplify, data in motion tends to affect national security work primarily. Data at rest tends to affect criminal work primarily. But the two are coming together because encryption of both data at rest and data in motion is becoming ubiquitous. So that's probably, and so you take WhatsApp. WhatsApp is has over a billion customers, and so overwhelmingly good people, but in that billion customers are terrorists and criminals, and so that now ubiquitous feature of all WhatsApp products will affect both sides of the house.
Including the Brussels attackers, right? They were using WhatsApp?
Yeah, I don't want to say, but it's a huge feature of terrorist trade craft, and by its ubiquitousness, if that's even a word.
Ubiquity.
It's becoming, it's affecting the criminal work in huge ways.
So are you thinking of bringing a case against WhatsApp? Or is this under consideration?
I'm not, but it's going to be, inevitably, it will be an impediment to criminal wiretap orders in criminal cases and national security wiretap orders in national security cases. Whether there'll be litigation down the road, I don't know. But that collision is going to happen just the way it's happening in data at rest.
Can you, spoke about the off-ramp option earlier and the intervention groups. Can you describe a little bit more when you would foresee that being used? And is it the kind of option, had it been available, that the FBI would have used in cases that it did break through the criminal system?
Yeah, thank you. I don't know of an example where we would have used it. So, no, I don't. Which is why I imagine it's going to be of marginal utility going down the road. But the idea is, let's imagine we have a 16-year-old that we've either encountered online or someone has reported to us is expressing affiliation for ISIL. And so we look at it and say, you know, actually this kid hasn't moved towards trying to be a killer. He's actually just confused and screwed up, and he's looking for sources of meaning. It's early yet. Wonder if we could introduce him to the Shared Responsibility Committee and see if they can help the kid as a possible off-ramp. That's the idea. I honestly don't imagine it happening a lot, because going backwards, I can't think of a case where we would have used it.
And can I ask about some comments that were made by one of your predecessors up in New York City, the very reticent Mayor Giuliani? He mentioned that while he was running the U.S. Attorney's Office there, a fair amount of information that they dealt with in certain types of investigations was classified, and that at least on occasion he was fairly confident that some lawyers in office probably took home some of the information that was classified when they were feeling overworked or behind the eight ball. Do you think that ever happened while you were in charge of that office?
The place got much better when I took over. I honestly don't know what he's talking about, but there's no doubt. I mean, the government investigates it all the time, administrative investigations, sometimes criminal investigations of mishandling of classified information. But I don't know. Yeah, I don't know of a case where it happened. The incidents of classified information in our cases in SDNY was sufficiently unusual. I think people showed great, great care. So that's my reaction.
Just
last bounce. He bounced in early, but I'm going to bounce back.
Take another shot, Clinton emails. I guess it's impossible to sort of separate this from the presidential race, and we're only 6 months out at this point. I mean, do you feel a personal responsibility to the American people to sort of wrap this up or get it to a solution as quickly as possible here?
I'm going to stick with what I said earlier. Yeah. I couldn't have said it any better.
Just following up on that.
So we're going to reverse bounce now. Mike.
On the WhatsApp, to what extent did the conspirators in Paris and Brussels use encrypted apps such as that?
I'm not in a position where I feel comfortable giving you details. There is no so I guess I'm going to avoid the particular investigation, and I'll just state it in general. Highly confident that the use of encryption, both for data at rest and data in motion, is now essential tradecraft of ISIL and other terrorist groups, but especially ISIL.
Speaking of ISIS, the last time we talked, you said you'd seen a leveling off of foreign traveler cases. Where does that stand? And backing up from just that isolated part of it, what is your sense now about the volume of ISIS recruitment in the United States? Is it still at the same level? Have you seen any change there?
I think the ISIL, the so-called Islamic State brand, has lost significant power in the United States. We are seeing that trend has continued since we talked about it in October, whereas
that trend, you mean
that is the drop in the number of people traveling or attempting to travel. So and I'll probably screw up the numbers, but you'll get the idea. You imagine 14 in the first half of 2015, we were seeing 6, 8, 10 a month people trying to travel or successfully traveling. Since last August, it's averaged about one a month. And so that trend is now sustained, and it's gone on for coming up on a year this August. So there's no doubt that something has happened that is lasting in terms of the attractiveness of the nightmare, which is the Islamic State, to people from the United States. That's true. Their ability to motivate troubled souls, to inspire them, remains a persistent presence in the United States. We have north of 1,000 cases where we're trying to evaluate where somebody is on the spectrum from consuming to acting, and that number continues to tick up slowly. We haven't seen a material change there. So there's still a presence online, and troubled people are still turning to this and at least being interested in it. But they've lost their ability to attract people to their caliphate from the United States in a material way.
So just to be crystal clear, in terms of people trying to go physically, you're seeing a steep decline in that. But in terms of people consuming the social media who might be at some point inspired to do something, that's still a problem.
Yeah, and it still is a problem. I don't know the numbers well enough to characterize whether the rate of increase has changed. It ticks up slowly. So we have not seen the diminution that we see in the traveler world in the radicalizing online world. Catherine.
Yes, I have an ISIS-related question. These kill lists have gone from military to government now to average Americans. How would you assess the credibility of the threat? And is it really down to local and state to notify people, or do you see a larger role for the feds in this?
First of all, we, often with our Joint Terrorism Task Force partners in New York, we just recently did it with NYPD, we have a duty to warn, which we take very, very seriously, and so we go and try to find everybody on any list that's put out in the United States. ISIL's been engaged in the so-called doxing since the beginning. What's interesting is their lists have gotten less specific and more like they just pulled it out of the phone book or found it on a website somewhere, which is an interesting trend. I don't know exactly what that shows, but you remember 2 years ago they were focused on particular lists of service members. Right. Now they're drifting towards just putting out hundreds of people that they pulled off some...
like municipal databases.
Yeah, and so now they're sort of publishing portions of the phone book. But look, we take it very seriously, and I'm sure it ruins a whole lot of people's days. We go find those folks and say, Joe Smith, just want you to know your name was on this list. Okay. We don't have any specific credible threat that's focused on you, but we want you to know this. If you see anything that concerns you, please call us. And so we do that with hundreds and hundreds of people.
So given what you were just saying, that there's upwards of 1,000 cases, right, of people where you're trying to figure out where they are in the spectrum as it relates to ISIS, how concerned are you about a Paris-style attack or Brussels-style attack happening in the United States? Because we haven't met since, you know, before that, and now obviously a lot has changed.
Well, it's something we focus on every day, and I guess we've been doing this now for 2 years and how long have I been in this job? 8 months? And you remember way back 2 years ago, we talked about how we in the FBI see three strands to this threat. The effort to attract people to come to the caliphate, the effort to use social media and others to inspire people to act, and the third is people who've traveled to the war zone, gotten the worst kind of training, coming back out to kill people. and that terrorist diaspora, I've talked about for a long time, someday is going to be much larger than the terrorist diaspora out of Afghanistan by the Mujahideen after the 1980s. And so what we see in Paris and Brussels is a manifestation of that element of the threat. The killers who travel and then return to engage in acts of violence, we have far fewer people in real numbers and dramatically far fewer per capita from the United States that have gone there. But that's not our only focus. We're focused on those people. We're also very much focused on people coming back to the EU and then making a hop over here. We see no evidence of a plot like that in the United States, but we know that, first of all, we know they acknowledge privately, the ISIL savages, how hard it is to get into the United States, but they very much want to. And so we know that third prong of the threat is something we have to worry about every single day.
Now, with the Europe concern, though, I mean, there is an ongoing issue with information sharing. Regardless of what officials say publicly, there is still behind-the-scenes issues there. Can you just kind of elaborate on that and what your concerns are with the information sharing and with their lack of a comprehensive database of terrorists?
Yeah, I've had lots of conversations with European colleagues about this. And I worry when I talk to them about it that I sound arrogant, and I really don't mean to. 3,000 people were murdered in our country 15 years ago. We as a country then set out to change the way we approach counterterrorism dramatically. And we've invested tens, probably hundreds of billions of dollars since then in this country. And that has bought us a capability that is really good. Not perfect, but really good. That took us 15 years of effort. Our European colleagues have not gone on that journey, and Paris and Brussels is spurring them to move farther down that journey. So what we're trying to do is help them in any way we can, show them what we've learned, what we've done over the last 15 years, and that the answer has to be breaking down all silos that separate information and operations from each other. We've done it across cities. So think of the progress we've made in the relationship between NYPD and FBI in 15 years. So what they have to do in Europe is take that and replicate it across over 20 countries, many different cultures, and so it's a very hard thing to do. I know they're motivated to do it, and our goal is to help them as much as we can without sounding like, you know, we know the world, but help them as much as we can make that journey and as fast as they can. But it's hard. Think of what we've done for 15 years. It's really hard.
But it also affects, that's not just them, because you said your big concern is that someone from the EU zone could make it into the U.S., and if there's not adequate information sharing with the U.S., then someone could, you know, hypothetically slip through, right?
Oh, sure. That's why we spend so much time trying to build information sharing agreements with partners all over the world, not just in Europe. Why we spend so much time investing in our legal attaché operations, our relationships with our counterterrorism partners, because that's the answer. We have to. Europe is hours from here by an air flight, and so we think of it as part of the same threat environment. And this is something else that I've shared with our European partners. One of the things we've done in this country is decide to be safe as Americans. We have to understand any threat anywhere in the world. And so I begin each morning with a briefing about terrorist-related threats worldwide. So if there's a threat in Madagascar that isn't particularly aimed at Americans, I'm going to hear about it, because our theory is a threat anywhere could be a threat here or a threat to Americans overseas. So what I've said to our European counterparts is that's the way we've approached the world now after the pain of 3,000 people murdered in our country. And so we think about it worldwide, and so please ask us. We will share with you what we know. I'm picking on Madagascar because I figure I don't know anyone in Madagascar. But we may know something about Madagascar that you wouldn't have imagined that the FBI would know about Madagascar. But it's because of the way America has decided to think about the terrorism threat, think about it globally, so we can be safe, that allows us to help you in ways you might not expect.
Mr. Director, I have a question about something relating to crime in terms of law enforcement's ability to get information to protect people when they need help. The case last week involving the federal police officer who went on the shooting spree.
In Maryland.
Turns out that there was a protective order issued
and the order required him to turn in all weapons. But as we reported the story out this week, we found out that it was basically an honor system, that he was to turn in the weapons that he had. There were two registered for the state of Maryland, but he had other weapons. He turned in 7 or 8. He withheld information about a gun that he bought legally that they found out about after the fact. So you have a situation where his wife went to the court and said, I know he has these weapons. The court said, you must turn in those weapons. But there was information out there about the weapon that was ultimately used to kill at least 2 people, allegedly, in Montgomery, Maryland, that the law enforcement did not have access to. Does that strike you as a system that needs fixing, where law enforcement can get the information that they need to protect people?
I guess I don't know enough, certainly about the particular, to comment. It all depends on what policy judgments have been made and what laws reflect those policy judgments, which is not my thing.
Yeah.
Then I'll go across there.
Right. A couple of questions. First, on transparency, the Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act, as you know, is coming up for reauthorization next year, and yesterday there was a hearing on the Hill, and one of the points that was raised, that I think the major sort of point of controversy, is the U.S. person query. Mm-hmm. And I believe that NSA and CIA can apparently track the rough number of U.S. person queries on the 702 data, the PRISM data. The FBI cannot, correct? Can you tell me if you're why you can't do it? Are you thinking of changing that so that you can track the number of queries made? And why wouldn't you, in the interest of transparency, since other agencies are able to do so?
Yeah, I know. I guess all I can say about that at this point is that the DNI is driving an effort to see what we can accomplish in that regard. And it's largely a system problem. Can you build your system in such a way to track it without grinding the entire operation to a halt? And so I know that work is underway now to figure out, and if we can't get a precise number, is there an estimate we can get that would be useful to people? Mm-hmm. I'm a huge fan of transparency, and especially around something like 702, which, to me, of the two things that were discussed, remember we had all the conversation about 215 mm-hmm. and 702, 702 is far more important. And so it's important to tell people as much as we possibly can about how it's used. So I think more to come on that space is the answer.
Just to clarify two of the answers you gave on the iPhone. So you said at the very beginning that there, if I understood right, there are roughly 500 phones and investigations that you cannot get into now. Is that right?
Correct. Our CART examiners, and Mike will get you the exact numbers, but it's something like 4,000 phones in the first 6 months of this fiscal year. And I think the number is about 500, might be 480
so,
or something.
So how many? So
it couldn't be opened.
You said you're looking at, then you said separately, you're looking now at the tool that you bought, that you won't tell us how much you paid for, but that's separate, and whether or not that can be used to get a phone. So how many of those 500 are potentially, can be opened with those? How many, are 5C iOS 9s?
I think, and you can get, Eric, the answer on this. I think the answer is none. I don't think any in that set, I think that's right, but I could be wrong about that. You'll have to check that with the STB people.
Okay. Yeah. And then separately back on Hillary emails for a second. The Petraeus investigation, what impact has that had on the current investigation into Secretary Clinton's emails in terms of lessons learned, the divisions that obviously came up with between the FBI and across the street, the questions of what criminal charges could and should be brought? That has to be looming over you at this point.
Yeah, I have no comment. All the way down the end.
To go back to some of the issues of race and diversity mentioned at least in passing at the beginning, it's been about a year, more than a year, since you gave your speech, February, I think, last year. How's the FBI doing on recruiting African-American and Latino agents? It seems like the numbers continue to mildly trend lower. Are you monitoring that, and can it be reversed, and maybe should it be reversed? Would the country be better off if people are interested in going into law enforcement to have them on the front lines of these police departments that are dealing with these hundreds and hundreds of murders than necessarily coming to the FBI?
Well, I hope both. First of all, yes, it can be. too early to say whether we're going to be able to change the inflection of the line. Lots going on in the FBI to try and change that. And I'll probably have a better sense at the end of this year as to whether we're seeing a change. Anecdotally, I feel change in that area, change in the people who are expressing interest. I don't know whether that's our efforts or the show Quantico. I can't tell. But so more to come at the end of the year. But, yeah, I think both is possible. And, in fact, I went and spoke to the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives in Atlanta, and I said, I got to confess to you, our interests are not aligned, because what I want to have happen is you hire great people of color, give them some years of training. Our average age of entry is 29 for special agents. Then I want to steal them. So I'm hoping both, that the people will be attracted to law enforcement and understand it's a tremendous way to do community service. And so I think both can be true. And in a way, the more successful local law enforcement is at attracting a diverse workforce, the better that will set us up to be fed by that talent. That's how I think about it. I'll go here and then I'll go there. Catherine, I called on you.
Oh, okay, great. Okay. I'm hopeful that you can answer this one. So,
is it a Hillary Clinton
one? Yeah, but this is a really important. This is a really important issue, though.
Well, no, I don't doubt that all of your questions are important. I'm just telling you, I'm predicting the answer, so as short as you can.
I actually keep my questions very short.
Up till now.
I consistently hear from security clearance holders that if they had done a fraction of what had been done by Mrs. Clinton's team, that they would already be in jail. Can you assure people that Mrs. Clinton and her team are being held to the same standard and that there isn't a special set of rules because they are powerful and politically connected?
I'm not going to comment other than to say there are no special set of rules for anybody that the FBI investigates. Go ahead.
Just a real quick encryption-related question. What is your stance, regardless of this passage of the Burr-Feinstein legislation? Is that something that you think makes a lot of sense? And
yeah, I don't want to comment on it for the reasons I said, I think, when Brian asked, because we don't comment on particular legislation. I think it's good that the conversation is staying alive. One of the things I worried about post-San Bernardino litigation is, it'd be a shame if we stop talking about this, because it's going to be a bigger and bigger feature of all of our lives, both the way we live outside of the criminal justice system and then the way in which we investigate. Hold on, I was going to go to him.
Yeah. Speaking of Donald Trump, are you...
you want another email question, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
okay.
Not email, but are you comfortable with him getting security briefings as a nominee?
Yeah, I'm not going to comment on that. Great. I'll go down there, ma'am.
To clarify, the more than 1,000 cases that are open where you're trying to evaluate where someone's radicalizing, are all of those Islamic State cases potentially Islamic State sympathizers?
Sometimes we can't tell. I would estimate about 80% of them we know are Islamic State related.
80%. And then is there any equivalent scope?
And, you know, sometimes with people there's a mix. They're watching Anwar al-Awlaki videos, that kind of thing, so it's harder to tell.
Is there any equivalent scope you can give us for how many investigations you have open into domestic extremists, anti-government individuals? There's obviously been more indictments since the standoff in Oregon. Can you give a sense of how many investigations you've opened into that type of group?
Yeah, I can't. We have a lot, but I don't know the number off the top of my head. And I don't know... My instinct tells me it's less than 1,000, but Mike would have to check that for you.
Yeah. About Clinton, no, I'm just kidding. we're just talking about travelers. The FBI has arrested several people who wanted to go fight with ISIS in Syria. Some of them have been sentenced 5, 7, 8 years. How concerned are you that these people who wanted to go overseas will then get out of prison in the U.S. and be even more dangerous inside the U.S.?
I guess, optimistically, that after serving a long prison term, they'll be older, less unmoored, and then subject to a supervised release term. One of the strengths of the federal criminal justice system is long supervised release terms by really good probation officers. And so I think there's a reasonable prospect that by virtue of their age, by virtue of their learning that lesson, by virtue of their supervision, they will be materially different from a risk perspective. But there's always a worry.
Even given the radicalization in prison that we've seen in so many cases.
Yeah, we don't see a lot of radicalization, though, in the ISIL world, in American prisons. It's something we worry about and watch very carefully. But I actually do not sit here worrying a whole lot about people radicalizing in federal prisons, especially.
May I ask a question about San Bernardino?
Sure.
Given the Syed Farouk's interest in some kind of an attack well before ISIS came on the scene, do you, as FBI director, put the San Bernardino attack in an ISIS-inspired category or not? And if so, why?
I do now, because having gone through all we've gone through, it does appear that a dominant influence on them was the ISIL propaganda and ISIL's poison. But this comes back to the question earlier. Oftentimes, early in an investigation, or even afterwards, it's hard to untangle, because there will be Alaki videos, Al-Shabaab material, that kind of stuff in the mix. But we make a judgment based on our assessment of what was the primary motivator for these people. And, you know, a fairly typical path for people is they'll start with Alaki videos, which live forever on the internet, and then that'll be kind of be a gateway to a particular interest in a particular group.
And was that the fact here?
I don't remember clearly enough to tell you. I don't.
But looking back, do you think, gosh, we should have seen this, we missed something, any of that? Have you looked back?
Yeah, none of that yet in San Bernardino. We've thought about it very, very hard, which is highlights the challenge we face, is we cannot see something that we missed in these two killers. And so that obviously, sometimes you have asked me in the past, what I worry about most? What I worry about most is the ones we can't see. And that we've built this very good counterterrorism capability in the United States over 15 years, but it can't see everything. And then you add to that the increasing ubiquity, if I may use Pete's word, of encryption, both in motion and at rest, and that makes it even tougher to see.
Were they using, any indication they were using encryption?
What do I want to say? I can't say at this point. I know the answer, but I don't want to say.
November, Mikhail Lessin and this one-time close associate of Vladimir Putin was found dead in the Washington hotel room. The D.C. Medical Examiner found that it was a result of blunt force injuries to his neck and torso. D.C. police is still investigating. Is the FBI participating in that investigation?
We are monitoring it. And the D.C. police have the lead, but we've been kept informed.
You have reason to believe that his death was the result of actions by parties, directed by parties outside the United States.
I don't want to comment until the D.C. police have finished their work. What else?
Mr. Director, yes, just to follow up on the vulnerabilities equities process, do you think the fact that the Bureau can purchase an exploit, but not the underlying vulnerability, and thus not be able to submit to the VEP, amounts to a loophole in the process, which is supposed to be, was set up to help broker weighing of the equities amongst law enforcement, intelligence agencies, and the cybersecurity interests of protecting the public, to determine whether vulnerabilities used by the government should be disclosed. And then secondly, has the Bureau ever purchased an exploit before and still submitted the underlying flaws to the White House-led group?
The second part I'm not going to say. The first part, I don't think of it that way. I mean, this process is an informal process set up inside the government to help us figure out, so when should we share with companies vulnerabilities and not? So if we don't have a vulnerability, is that a loophole? I guess I wouldn't think of it that way. But maybe if you were shaping your investigative conduct to avoid triggering the VEP process, I don't know. But it didn't happen here, so I don't think of it that way.
Yeah. To follow up briefly on Pete's question, is your conclusion that the San Bernardino killers were inspired by ISIL, informed by what you found on the phone in connection with the tool that allowed you in.
Yeah, I'm not going to say.
One more question?
I've worn the map.
Done.
Oh, no, no, no.
Aren't you going to answer
I checked the shot clock.
Before the election. Can you at least tell us that?
I'm not saying.
Beyond what was publicly disclosed in terms of the couple swearing allegiance to an ISIS leader, can you give us any sense of how you came to the conclusion that the dominant influence was ISIS propaganda in relation to Sandra?
I can't. A huge feature is exploiting their media and understanding their
from that. It came from that.
What they've been looking at and what they've been following.
Did you just say to Pamela you can't assure people it'll be wrapped up before the election?
No, I said I can't answer that. I'm not going to answer a question like that.
Well, I mean, that seems to suggest it could last beyond the election.
No, I'm not commenting is what I'm about to say. Ma'am, right. You can't squeeze any more juice out of that one. I'm just not commenting. All right, everybody. All right. So we'll
Thank
see you,
you
again in 9 months.
Yeah.